This Week in Retronauts, the only podcast strong enough to wrestle the ears off a Gundark. Everyone, welcome to episode 266 of Retronauts. This time I actually planned it out and figured out what number it is. This is 266, wow. Unless we change up the schedule, in which case it is not 266, but we will burn that bridge when we cross it. We like to burn bridges. Anyway, I'm Jeremy Parrish, hosting this week, and with me here in this room, we have the usual assorted collection of star-studded luminaries. So, Star Studs, who are you?
Ben Elgin.
Benj Edwards.
I'm Chris Sims, and I want to talk about how C-3PO killed those dudes.
Which dudes?
The dudes that C-3PO kills at the beginning.
Which dudes?
At the beginning?
Yeah, when he rips off the sign that says that there's a Wampa in a room.
In the
why do they have a Wampa in the room for C-3PO to
well,
do
there's
Wampa?
A, there's in the like, deleted scene yeah. in which the Wampas invaded the base, and they corralled them into that room using R2-D2 as a Pied Piper-esque allure to hide them in a closet, and then they locked them in there, and then C-3PO.
Which, and like, wouldn't that have been convenient for video games if there were actually Wampas in the Rebel base?
Yes, wow. Yeah.
So are... Okay, hang on. I'm sorry. I know we're going to get into this in a minute, but I have a lot of questions. So are Wampas, like, animals, or are they, like, people? Sentient creatures?
Well, in the movie, they are only really presented as like creatures.
Yeah, it's a predator. Like, it's a predator.
Like grizzly bears, like, basically.
Yeah.
However, in one of the Expanded Universe novels, I do remember that they had to go back to Hoth for some reason, and there was a one-armed Wampa who had a look of hatred and revenge in his eyes.
Is this like how Jaws 2, or is it Jaws 3, is about the shark wanting revenge?
It's Jaws 2, The Revenge.
That's right, yeah. Jaws 2, The Revenge.
Because Jaws 3 was Jaws.
My question
3D.
Here is, why don't they shoot the Wampa instead of just putting a sign on a door? They had to print out the sign.
I don't know, man.
Don't feed the Wampas.
You'd think they'd need some meat supplies. I don't know.
Anyway, C-3PO does some murders. It's an important thing. Let's get into it.
I mean, he also was turned into like a battle droid in the prequels, and you're a big fan of those.
You know it.
Anyway.
I love those prequels like Anakin hates sand.
Wow. That is passionate. All right. So, yes, we are talking about Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, episode 5 of Star Wars, episode 5 of the Star Wars trilogy, because George Lucas cannot count. Anyway, with The Rise of Skywalker launching imminently. This is a December airing, even though we're not recording in December. The Star Wars nonology will be coming to a supposed end. And so we figured this would be a good time to continue our series of looking back at the Star Wars movies and the video games based on them. Benj?
No, I was just going to make a dumb joke. Hey, it's really cold outside.
What?
I was going to say, hey guys, it's really cold outside, brr.
See,
which
it's
doesn't
funny
make sense
right now. It's like
it was
80
degrees yesterday,
90 degrees,
yeah.
But people listening to this will not understand that.
Visualize
like I said,
Hoth would be good
if
right
there's a
now,
cool
yeah.
spot to the universe, this is the furthest point from it. So anyway, Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back. You might wish to refer back to, I don't know, an episode we did like a year and a half ago about the original Star Wars, A New Hope. And this is the sequel to that podcast episode because it's all about sequels. George Lucas always intended for Star Wars to have sequels, as you may know, but he wasn't sure how successful Star Wars was going to be because, as we talked about last time, it was, it was not really that good a movie until the very end, basically, when it came out. And then all of a sudden it was really cool and the editing came together, the music, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was a lot of question about, like, what will the follow-ups be to this saga that I have in my mind? Mm-hmm. So he had a dual-prong approach. If Star Wars was a success, he was going to make another movie. But if it was not a success, not a success. He was going to make some schlocky novels to serve as sequels. And as it turned out, he did both. And so that is where we end up with Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back. But before that, there was Star Wars Splinter of the Mind's Eye. Have you guys ever read
that? Oh, yeah. All right. Oh, yeah.
Chris, it sounds like you have opinions about Star Wars Splinter of the Mind's Eye. The only thing I remember about it was the part where, I can't remember, someone like forces another character to lick his boots. I think Darth Vader like Darth forces some licker. Dude to lick his boots or something. And I was like, wow, I was like 8 when I read that. And I was like, man, that seems really gross and weird.
Yeah, it's a real horny book.
Well, it wasn't like a sexual thing.
Oh, was it though?
It really wasn't. That wasn't.
I got Splinter of the Mind's Eye in the mid-90s because I was reading a ton of Expanded Universe Star Wars novels at the time.
So okay, sure. This movie dates back, or this book dates back to like 1979 or something.
It's very early, and shows.
I'm old enough that I remember when it was newish.
Well, I got the re-release, and the interesting thing about reading it with all three of the original Star Wars movies coming out is that it clearly doesn't line up. It was written by Alan Dean Foster, who also wrote the novelization of Star Wars, uncredited. The novel is also credited to George Lucas. But it features, I remember very specific things like Luke not knowing what a duck is, which I think is a very good bit that I wish, I'm sure there's a Wikipedia page called Ducks in the Star Wars.
Wait, yeah, who else in the Star Wars universe knows what a duck is?
Are we talking about the graveyard duck here?
Why does Obi-Wan know what a duck is?
Obi-Wan mentions something about, it's like he's talking about Anakin or something, and he says that someone like took to something like a duck to water. And Luke's like, what's a duck? Which I think is very funny.
Well, why would Obi-Wan know that? Because
he was well-traveled. Have you seen the Clone Wars?
Although, more importantly, was it a horrible duck? Did it steal everyone's shit?
That's a geese.
It was neither a horrible goose nor a graveyard duck.
At least he didn't say, like, a tark rat to water.
I like it much better when they just talk about ducks.
Yeah.
And, of course, the novel also has the extended Biggs scene. But there's very specific, like, dialogue and, like, writing quirks in the novel. So you can tell Splinter of the Mind's Eye is written by the same person, or at least is very similar in tone. It also has a section where Luke thinks he's going to die, so he confesses his love to Leia, which I feel like tells you how much was planned out.
Yeah, I mean, it's well established that Luke and Leia were not intended to be siblings. In fact, there was like the idea of Luke having a sibling was explored for the Empire Strikes Back script, but it was not Leia. It was someone who was like mentioned in the script and then never referenced again.
Yeah.
Hey, spoiler alert.
Sorry.
I mean, come on.
So it's this very weird experience of having all the Star Wars that we did in like 1997, 1998, like peak expanded universe Star Wars time, like, you know, Shadows of the Empire and Masters of Teras Kasai and like all of the books and comics. And thinking about how when Star Wars was the only piece of Star Wars that existed.
Besides the holiday special.
And like you said, no one knew if there was going to be anything else. So Star Wars tells a complete story, which I think is one of its one of the things that really recommends it as being. I honestly think it's kind of the best Star Wars movie because it stands on its own really well. But then imagining that like what you had if you really liked that movie was Splinter of the Mind's Eye and the Marvel comics, which were very weird and hugely successful.
Are we going to talk about Jackson?
I love Jackson. He's a giant green Star Wars
giant
rabbit.
Green space bunny.
Yeah, he's great.
Benj, you're shaking your head in pain.
Yeah, I thought this was the Empire Strikes Back podcast.
We're getting there.
Not the Splinter of Chris's Mind's Eye podcast.
But it's so weird, though, because Splinter of the Mind's Eye doesn't feel like Star Wars. It feels like a pulpy sci-fi novel, and it kind of feels like a Star Trek tie-in novel in a lot of ways, which were also like a big thing at the time.
They were just getting started, with the Ballantine books.
And doing one every month.
And Alan Dean Foster was writing those, too.
Bingo.
He was writing the mission logs, which were transcriptions, basically, like mini novelizations of the TV series.
Exactly.
And the cartoons.
So I was into both of these things at the same time and kind of going back and forth reading, you know, obviously, the new Next Generation novels that were coming out at the time. There's one that opens, by the way, side note to the side note to the side note, with Riker and Geordi playing on opposite sides of the Enterprise's Beach Volleyball League.
My God.
Which everyone should get, and that should be a movie.
maybe not now. They're kind of old now.
Frake still got it. Yeah. Frake still got it, baby.
Yeah.
That'd be but yeah, like, it's so weird to imagine a world where Star Wars didn't become Star Wars. It continued in this vein of, like, weird space fantasy pulp novels and weird space fantasy comics like we got from Marvel. And then Empire comes out, and it's so different and honestly so much better.
But I will say that when Empire Strikes Back was first conceived, when it was first written, it was very pulpy. By all accounts, the original script draft, and I don't think that's ever been released, but everyone who's seen it or seen bits of it has said, yes, it was very pulpy. And that is because the original draft was written by Lee Brackett, who was a pulpy science fiction author who had interned or, you know, studied under Robert Heinlein. And she had written a bunch of pulpy movies and a bunch of pulpy novels. And it was just like, that was her thing. And it's impossible to know how Brackett would have, you know, followed up in future drafts with her work, because she passed away just like a few weeks after she submitted the first draft. And, you know, a lot of the elements, like the major elements, were apparently present in her draft, but they were factored in very differently. Like the love triangle between Luke and Leia and Han was much more prominent. And like half the movie took place on Hoth. And you don't get the big revelation at the end with Darth Vader talking to Luke. So, you know, some of the key beats and elements were very different. And Lucas actually came in and did a second draft where he basically came up with a structure of the movie that we see now, which was basically like shifting assets and details and things around from what Brackett wrote. And then the final draft was written by Lawrence Kasdan, who had just written Raiders of the Lost Ark and is a brilliant writer, really, really just like nailed the dialogue, everything except that weird, like, flirty scene in the Hoth medical bay, which has always been really awkward. But everything else about the movie, like the dialogue is spot on. It was, you know, three people working together, kind of progressively taking Empire Strikes Back from that sort of Alan Dean Foster Star Trek novel, you know, kind of paperback sci-fi style to something that is much better. And I think most people, or a lot of people, recognize Empire Strikes Back as, if not the best Star Wars movie, then certainly right up there at the very top. And it, as you said before, you know, the fact that it's not a self-contained movie, it's the opposite of a self-contained movie, does hurt it somewhat. And it was a big risk when it was first released, because, you know, at this point, the idea of movies as franchises is inescapable. There's no turning back now. And that's probably because of Star Wars. But at the time, in the 70s and the 80s, the early 80s, the idea of a movie sequel was basically like, hey, I'd like to lose a lot of money. Sequels just did not perform anywhere near as well as the movies they were based on. I mean, you know, something like The Godfather Part II did not perform as well as the original Godfather. So Lucas was actually taking a pretty big risk by creating a sequel to his hit movie. And I don't think the studios were really into it, so he ended up self-financing it. That also gave him great control over the licensing rights and, you know, the creative direction. But he ended up self-funding most of it until it went over budget by like $10 million. And Bank of America was like, whoa, that's a lot of a loan money there. So Fox ended up helping to finance it, and they got some cut of the rights and everything. But, you know, it was kind of like the original Star Wars. It was a passion project that he really believed in. And felt like this is going to make a lot of money. And it paid off. Adjusted for inflation, Empire Strikes Back is the highest grossing film sequel of all time.
I'm not surprised.
It's a very good movie.
It is.
It's in my opinion, it is the best Star Wars movie, followed very closely by, that's right, The Last Jedi, I said.
I'm with you on those. But I'm also really curious about like the reception of this, like when it first released, because again, so this was 1980, right? So you know, I was four, so I was not very aware of the cultural zeitgeist in 1980. But like, I'm curious about this because, like, you know, you'd had Star Wars and it was, you know, an unexpectedly big success. But like the end of that is, right, we blow up the Death Star. We won. The good guys won. And then you come into the opening of Empire and it's like, no, actually not. Like, actually, the good guys are struggling. Everything's going bad. And I'm like, what was the reaction of people coming into the theater to this? Like, was it shocking? Because, again, you know, we didn't have, you know, everyone didn't know everything about the upcoming movies on the internet back then.
Right. So speaking as an old, I was there for this. And I distinctly remember that at the time, Empire Strikes Back was, you know, well received. People liked the cool set pieces and stuff. Yoda was very popular. But overall, the critical reception was kind of muted, and, you know, the popular reception was kind of like, well, this is sort of the least of the Star Wars movies because it doesn't really tell a full story, and it ends on such a downer, and, you know, it's very incomplete. And I think it was really like 10 years later that people started to sort of rehabilitate and reevaluate The Empire Strikes Back and go back and say, you know what, actually, you know, now that we see where this fits into the story, and we kind of are better at observing Return of the Jedi's flaws. You know, maybe this movie wasn't so bad. And I think its opinion, its reputation has gradually grown over time. And I don't think it's some sort of like, you know, I don't think it's insincere. I don't think there's like some sort of overrating going on here. I think people just have kind of come to appreciate better, like, the really excellent filmic qualities of the movie, like how well it's directed, how great the cinematography is, the set design, just how everything fits together. And it does tell this kind of important middle chapter of a story. And middle chapters are hard. It's easy to tell beginnings and it's easy to come up with a cool ending. But that middle part where you're like, how do we move the plot forward? How do we move the story forward? That's tough. And this movie does a really good job of it.
Yeah. And I think that's true, that you really need the context for it. Like, the moment to moment of this movie is some of the best stuff that exists in the Star Wars series, but it needs its context to make any sense. But in some sense, both the before and after context.
I love this film. I love it so much. It's probably my favorite movie of all time. And there's what I love the most about it is every scene has the perfect tone. Nothing falls flat.
Except the sick bay.
Yeah, that's a little awkward where he's grinning and stuff. But other than that, I mean, it's just everything is just so perfect. The dialogue is great. And I mean, there's just little things. Like, one of my favorite things is where, like, Han is like, where's Luke, you know? And then C-3PO comes up and he puts his hand over his mouth. And he's like talking to him, you know? And like that kind of stuff is like so fluidly put together. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that going on in the film. It's just, it's the greatest film.
And heck, just the, compared to a lot of the rest of the Star Wars saga, the fact that the dialogue is actually good is amazing.
Well, it's good, one with a good dialogue.
A big part of what makes this movie great is that, unlike the first movie, Lucas, which is great, but unlike that first movie, Lucas stepped back and let other people have more creative control. And the director, Irving Kirshner, was a very experienced movie director who didn't really have any hits under his belt. And Lucas liked him because he apparently was, you know, kind of saw him as an outsider who wasn't part of the Hollywood system and wasn't going to kind of operate in the same limiting ways as most Hollywood insiders. And Kirshner had a very different directorial approach than Lucas. Lucas is kind of famous for basically like doing two or three takes, just like Jonathan Frakes, two takes Frakes. He does
one shot close up. That's all he needs.
Yep. He does like two or three takes and doesn't give dialogue notes to the actors, doesn't really give them much direction whatsoever. Whereas Kirshner, like, he would have conferences with the lead actors and talk to them, like, let's talk about your motivations in this scene. Let's fine tune the script. Let's, you know, really talk about staging and what you're going to do and what you're feeling and trying to accomplish here. And it really shows because, you know, there is a lot of, you know, a lot of kind of personal moments in this, more so than in many of the other Star Wars movies. You know, whether it's Leia and Han and the Falcon kind of like flirtatiously and kind of prickly, you know, together, like, do they love each other? They do, but they also kind of don't like each other. Mm-hmm. Getting over that, and Luke with Yoda, like, you know, Mark Hamill is acting with a puppet and, you know, doing a hard physical labor for like half an hour.
A puppet operated by one of the greatest puppeteers of all time.
It is, but nevertheless, it is a puppet. And there's a lot of great stuff that comes out of that.
Yeah, it's incredible they managed to sell the Yoda thing so well, considering how badly it could have gone. you know, with a puppet and with
he never feels like a puppet.
Yeah, in it's the movie. So it's damn good.
And I think that's true of a lot of things in this movie. Like some of the like the Han and Leia flirting scenes. I mean, maybe outside the med bay, but there's a lot of this through the movie of them flirting. And in a lot of ways, it's really dated now. You know, Han is the bad boy scoundrel, and like I could see scenes like
he's
this.
He's nice men.
Nice man. He's a very nice man. But you know, there's a lot of ways that scenes of that nature could come off so badly now in the modern context, but like just the dialogue and the chemistry between them is so good that it still works. Like,
yeah, I do think a lot of what helps that is that Han Solo, as played by Harrison Ford, is a huge dork who is pretending to be a cool guy.
Yes.
And also and Carrie Fisher is tough as nails. She's flinty and strong. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like absolutely. That totally goes away in Return of the Jedi, but here like is peak Carrie Fisher, like really coming through in, in the role, and she's in charge of most scenes that she's in. Like you really get the idea. Like, yes, this is a born leader. Like she has
an incredible presence.
Yeah, she does. Yeah. And you can see why Han is, you know, kind of like throwing his bravado at her, because like who wouldn't be in love with Princess Leia? But you know, he had to kind of work through her defenses and yeah, like it just works.
And again, I think this is the director working to the strengths of both the actors and the characters that he has, and just showing off the best parts of them, which is something that fails to happen in some other Star Wars movies.
This film has a lot of humor too, and it's got a lot of funny stuff without being a comedy, which is why like it doesn't go too far in any direction of being silly or ridiculous. Just like some
Yoda is silly at first, but that's by design. Mm-hmm. Like he's deliberately being obnoxious.
He's playing it up
to provoke Luke.
Yeah,
but Han Solo, there's just all these funny things with Han too. Like there's a scene where I don't remember where they are, but you know, he's down in a pit in the Falcon, like fixing it, and something gets
the toolbox falls on his head.
And he goes, ow!
The hydro spanner.
That's funny. It's just that little thing. Just a little thing, you know, that adds
to it. It's not my fault. Han is so put upon through this whole movie. Like, just everything goes wrong
for him. Han Solo is the best. Like, I think he's the best part of this film.
I think the thing that people often forget about the two major Harrison Ford characters of the 70s and 80s, when they try to recreate them, like there's a lot of very bad Han Solo and Indiana Jones knockoffs. And I feel like the thing they miss is that Indiana Jones is a huge nerd who gets beat up a lot. And Han Solo is a gigantic dork who is introduced to us bragging about his car to an old man. And then is constantly like trying to play a cool guy. And I think Ford does a really good job with that. Mm-hmm. There's an aspect of this movie that I think is really interesting structurally, in that it does have that pulpy set piece structure that works so well in Star Wars and the Indiana Jones movies and in Jedi. Like you think of Empire and you've got these clearly delineated set piece acts. You've got Hoth and then Dagobah and Cloud City and then back to Dagobah and then back to Cloud City for the big thing at the end. But it's the focus is so much on the emotional core and the storytelling and the dialogue and the character work, because this is the most character work that we get in the entire trilogy.
The entire series. The entire franchise.
I mean, arguably, yeah.
I guess you could go into Clone Wars and stuff.
Don't forget about episode 2.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, you really get into what makes Anakin tick. Yeah, sand,
hates
basically.
Sand.
And sand people.
I do feel like that is why. And we're going to get into this in a minute, because we're going to talk about video games in a second, I think.
Not so much a second, but yes, later.
In a little bit.
Star Wars and Jedi, I think, rely much more on those set pieces, which makes them easy to translate into the type of video games that they were translated into. And I'm specifically, like, my big experience was with Super Star Wars, Super Empire Strikes Back, and Super Return of the Jedi on Super NES.
Mm-hmm.
Because Star Wars is just action set piece to action set piece. And they're all good. Jedi doesn't have those, or Empire doesn't have those, because there is no way, like, press X to deny that you are Darth Vader's son.
Yeah, it's like you get the Hoth battle at the beginning, and then it turns into a different movie. Like, there would be, I think, a great visual dating sim, like visual novel dating sim based on, like, the flirtation of Han Solo and Princess Leia.
There's stretches on like Cloud City where there's no violence going on. It's characters doing things. Yeah.
And then you get stuff that like Han Solo being tortured that also doesn't translate to video games.
I mean, you can do that in Metal Gear Solid. You mash the circle button to survive, and then Meryl doesn't die. You don't remember that?
I never played Metal Gear Solid.
I don't know. I've seen this movie 100 times. It's probably one of the most replayable films I've ever seen. I can never get tired of it. I've seen it every single time I watch it. I love it again, and I don't get tired of it. I don't know what it is about it, because it just everything, every note is hit perfectly in the right way. For me, anyway, for me of my culture, of my generation, I mean, this is the perfect film. So it's just, man. The only other movies I've seen that often are Ghostbusters and Big Trouble in Little China or something like that.
Interesting.
Those are better than Ghostbusters.
You know,
probably not better than Big Trouble in Little China.
I don't know. This is the most filmic of the three. Mm-hmm. Although I love Ghostbusters too.
It's also like incredibly full of memorable lines. Like there's so much quotable stuff in this movie. Actually, and some of them are particularly burned into my brain because I had this like sound resource pack for like my Mac Plus that like replaced all the system sounds with like lines from Empire Strikes Back and like so the like, you know, the like Darth Vader impressive and the like Yoda stuff and like it would just these would just be spouting out of my computer for my formative years. So it was but they are like, there's, you know, all the famous Yoda lines are in this and like a bunch of good Darth Vader stuff.
When you think about what's good about Empire, you think about character moments, you think about I love you, I know. You think about do or do not. You think about I'm your father. Those are all like very big character driven moments. When you think about what's good about Star Wars, or honestly what's good about Jedi, you think about action. You think about blowing up the Death Star and you know,
choking out a giant worm with a chain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, why not?
You know, and having 200
knocking Boba Fett into a space butthole.
Sarlacc. That's what you get for being in the holiday special, you ass.
Yeah. But yeah, like, I mean, honestly, if you want to see the difference in those movies, Empire makes Boba Fett seem super cool by just with two words, no disintegrations.
That he doesn't even speak. He doesn't say those himself.
He doesn't. But he does do like the only actual like useful thing he does on screen, which is to figure out what Han's scheme is to get away from the Star Destroyer.
Yeah. Like that made everybody think that Boba Fett was cool for the next 30 years, despite every other thing he was in, him being terrible.
Oh, man. It's just
but his design's cool. Yeah. That's a Macquarie design too, isn't it? The Boba Fett.
It is.
Fett
he was originally the Boba super Fett. Stormtrooper, and then they modified that.
Boba Fett. Okay, where? That's Jedi. Yeah. Sorry.
That's another thing there's a lot of in Empire. It's a lot of really cool Macquarie designs.
Let's talk about Yoda a little bit more.
Yeah, I was going to actually go there because I really feel like if you want to get to the heart of what makes Empire Strikes Back, I think kind of speaks to what Lucas wanted to accomplish. It's what Yoda is, because he's presented as go find the Jedi master who instructed Obi-Wan Kenobi. Mm-hmm. Holy crap, that guy's got to be badass. Yeah. He's going to be amazing. He's going to be like... so cool.
So
and no,
strong.
He's like, he's a little green thing that talks like Grover.
Yeah.
Like, but he's like the German version of Grover with his reverse syntax.
Which is such an incredible, and again, it's something that I don't think today, if you weren't there at the time, and I wasn't, but you know, going back and looking at what existed when, I think it's impossible to appreciate what a good swerve Yoda is. Because Luke says he's looking for a great warrior. And then
wars not make one
exactly,
great.
Exactly. Wars don't make one great. And then that's so beautiful and such an interesting lesson and such a good translation of what the difference is between the light side and the dark side. And then it is completely, like, I'm not going to talk about the prequels a lot, but it's completely destroyed. In episode 2, where, oh no, it turns out Yoda's actually super good at fighting and is going to fight Christopher Lee. Yeah. An 80-year-old man and a puppet are going to have a great action sequence. A puppet who looks more like a puppet now.
It's a flip. Yeah, he flips around a lot. Yeah, like, that just ruins everything. Don't even bring that up.
But that whole sequence, terrible. Like, from Yoda's introduction to like the reveal that he's the guy is so good and so like well paced and such an incredible bit of character work and acting from Frank Oz.
Frank Oz is amazing.
Who again is acting through a, you know, through an inanimate object.
Yeah, it's
never feels like it.
It's part of like a film legacy that was very unique to that period that has been completely lost. I realized there was just a Dark Crystal sequel on Netflix, which I haven't seen yet, but I hear it's really good.
I've heard good things.
But, I've been meaning to watch it. Yeah.
But like the idea of here is like a bizarre fantasy that you take seriously, but it's acted out by puppets. Like that was, there just wasn't a lot of that. It was a very short-lived thing. Like this very brief period where Jim Henson's technology got good enough that you could actually believe these characters and them being phased out in favor of, you know, CG.
Mm-hmm. And I think it is, like, I like a lot of modern movies that rely heavily on CG, obviously. Like, I think it's fantastic in Endgame. Like, the Hulk looks like a guy. Like, it looks like the Hulk is there. He looks like Mark Ruffalo. Like, he has does, good acting.
But, I mean, I can still tell it's CG.
Yeah. But there is such a, and this applies to Star Wars as well. It's such a different feeling when it's real. Like when there is a physical object being filmed that is present on the set, whether it's the Death Star blowing up, whether it's the, you know, miniatures or matte paintings. I love matte paintings. Or whether it's Frank Oz crouching down on a soundstage meant to look like a swamp.
Yeah, I feel what Hollywood has mostly lost is that CG is best when it's used to embellish and enhance things that are already there. Like they use CG now in Star Wars movies to like do everything. I've seen shots like before and after shots of cockpits in Rogue One where it's like the seat and the person sitting in it are real. Everything else is white. And then they put all the control panels and surfaces and dials and stuff in with CG. Man. Like, is that really necessary? Yeah.
Which is weird because you would think like if anything had the money to build the sets and then enhance them with what is presumably less expensive, which is CG, which is why it's so commonly used. You'd think it would be Star Wars.
Right.
You'd think they know at this point it's going to make money.
But yeah, there's definitely a physicality to everything on Dagobah. Like they are in a massive swampy set full of trees and actual snakes
water,
and a little and crazy green puppet.
Yoda bopping R2 with his cane would not work if it wasn't a physical object interacting with a physical object. If it wasn't Frank Oz and Kenny Baker like
having it out,
like doing that on the set, it wouldn't work. Especially wouldn't have worked at the time. I don't think it would work now.
Has anyone else lived their entire life by the philosophy of Yoda? And then you just realize, wait a minute, I hope it was good, like good philosophy.
No.
You don't? Okay, gosh.
I'm a Spider-Man guy, philosophically.
Really?
Yeah. I think I
actually still try things, so I can't comment on that.
There's some Irvin Kershner commentary on the DVD version that's interesting, where he says... they got that from, it's sort of like watered down Buddhist kind of stuff. And he was surprised at how it resonated with people so much, his advice. And
it's almost like Buddhists know what's up.
Yeah, maybe they do.
Yeah. But
there's what's in that cave, only what you take with you. I mean, there's so many deep moments in that little thing, you know?
Yeah.
Everything that Yoda presents to Luke is done in a way that, you know, it kind of comes at Luke sideways, and the viewer too, because you go into it having been prepped by the first Star Wars and the intro to this movie, which is a big battle on Hoth. And so you just think, oh, you know, action movie, everything is about solving, mm-hmm. you know, resolving problems through conflict. But the whole point of basically Yoda's belief in the Force is that, no, that's not what it's about. It's about really like knowing your limits and understanding your place in the universe. And, you know, those are hard lessons for Luke to come by, but the Dagobah scenes basically sort of break him down and break down his expectations without, you know, without demeaning the character or diminishing him in any way. It's basically saying like, you didn't have a lot of good examples growing up, but here's what's actually going on. Now you need to like apply this to the confrontation that's ahead of you that you're rushing into.
It's one of the only times in the larger franchise that the Kung Fu movie and like samurai movie and Buddhist Zen Buddhism stuff feel like it has been made its own thing. Because it's all like very obviously and very heavily influenced, but it's also done in a way that I feel like is very unique to Star Wars. A lot of it being because it is introduced by Yoda, who doesn't feel like is very clearly, you know, the wise hermit monk living in the mountains, except it's a swamp and he's a puppet. But he doesn't feel like that. He feels like, oh, this is what a Jedi master is. Because we've seen Obi-Wan, and we know that Obi-Wan is also a weird hermit who lives alone in a desert. Mm-hmm. But Yoda is all of that aesthetic just cranked up so much and is so like the swerve is so good. And he's so concerned, not just about like Luke's well-being, but the idea of all we are doing is giving him the tools to be a bad guy. Which I think is a really interesting thing. There's such a good vulnerability with these characters. Like every good guy in the movie has extreme moments of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Luke obviously has multiple ones, but Han gets tortured. And Leia is very like the whole situation on Cloud City is out of her control. We meet Lando and Lando's being bossed around.
Leia is supposed to, you know, be off with the Rebel Command. She gets cut off from the escape from Hoth and ends up going with Han. And it's totally out of her control because Han is, you know, in addition to all of his other great qualities, he's really bad at maintaining his own spaceship, which is, you know, just basically like a high performance piece of garbage. It's like a junky looking space Jaguar. It's like a Jaguar. It's like got a race car engine.
A jalopy.
And also like the body is the RV from Breaking Bad.
It should have a spoiler that's the wrong color and a Dale Earnhardt 3 painted on the cockpit, honestly.
So this is what I want to know before we talk about video games. Is Yoda doesn't want Luke to go help his friends because it's a trap and stuff. And Ben doesn't either. So what do they expect to happen? They expect him to sacrifice his friends and then train up and then go fight Darth Vader?
Yeah, for the greater good.
Fine? Yeah, if he honors what they fight for is what Yoda says. Like... If you honor, you know, the fact that they're trying to thwart the Galactic Empire, trying to rid the galaxy of evil, yes, you let them, you know, let what things sacrifice. Happen to them because you are not ready yet. Like, you can't go.
Although, on the other hand, a through line through all these movies that gets explored a lot more in the sequels is that, you know, just because you're a Jedi doesn't mean you're always right either.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what Ben and Yoda think is the best. That doesn't necessarily mean they're right.
But there's a very compelling reason why they think that.
Oh, yeah.
And it's because of Anakin, which we get.
Absolutely.
Like, the reveal that we get at the end.
And that's actually, I think, the other part of the movie we need to talk about is the fact that basically the entirety of The Empire Strikes Back, the story here is just that it's not that the Empire wants revenge. It's not that like they're pissed off about the Death Star and they're going to take down the rebels. They were going to do that anyway. The story here is that very specifically Darth Vader, after surviving the Death Star explosion, just wants to get a hold of Luke.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, why is he so obsessed over Luke? Because that's the through line in this movie. It's about like, there's the Falcon, Skywalker's with them. And it's clearly driving him to the point that he's sacrificing entire warships to asteroid belts just so he can capture this one stupid little ship that they could easily blow out of the sky. But he wants to capture it because it's got Luke Skywalker in there. And so there is this kind of sort of question lurking in the background, like, what's Darth Vader's deal this entire time? He even has a chat with his boss, the Emperor, who is a woman and a monkey, and talks like an old person. And so at the end, you finally discover why Darth Vader is so obsessed with capturing Luke. And it's very personal.
I do wish there had been more. This is not the angry prequel criticism, but like, I do wish there would have been more thematic resonance with that, where the same tactic had worked on Anakin when he was younger. And like, unless I'm misremembering, like there's no real, they're holding his friends hostage moment, right?
Anakin's angle was wanting to overcome death and like being worried for Padme.
I guess his mom.
Yeah.
When he goes and gets her, but that's not like a trap. That's just,
I don't know. The whole prequel's kind of low.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was an angle, but it was a different, it was the temptation of wanting to be the master over death.
Yeah.
Which is what the Emperor was presenting to him. But
yeah. The one funny thing about Ben, I just noticed when they say, don't go, you know, to Luke, Ben steps forward, this ghost, and he says, wait, you know, and holds his hand out like, don't leave me here on Dagobah. Like,
it smells bad here. Like, he can go. See what this guy eats? It's so gross.
I have a lot of questions about how Force ghosts work.
Wait, Luke, I can only tell you this on Dagobah. You know, like, but he can show up anywhere.
Well, I don't think he can show up near Darth Vader. I think he has to be someplace, you know, anchored by the light side of the Force. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. According to the web comic, where it's a D&D game, it's a cloud of midichlorians.
Okay, so anyway,
I mean, it would be great if like every time we weren't looking at Darth Vader, there was just like a spectral Alec Guinness like dunking on him, like floating behind him.
That would be a great AR thing, you know, for augmented reality app. Have a like a
Metal Gear Solid 2 did that. Where are you going? Anyway,
okay, like an Obi-Wan in your own room.
Choke Captain Nita to death again? Cool.
Yeah, that's
good move.
Good call.
It's a good film.
Mm-hmm. It is a good film, and yeah. So the big plot reveal at the very end, the thing that everything leads up to. Mm-hmm.
Spoilers.
You may wanna walk away if you haven't heard this before.
Plug your kids.
Darth Vader claims to be Luke Skywalker's father, despite what Ben Kenobi told him that Darth Vader murdered his father. He's actually
from a certain point of view.
Obi-Wan lied to you, and I'm your dad, and you know I've got the receipts. I don't got the receipts, but check the paternity payments. I've been, you know, paying my alimony for the past 20 years. Sorry, kid.
He doesn't want him to go see Darth Vader, because he'll figure out that he was lying to him the whole time.
Well, yeah, there's that. But I think, you know, it's mostly he doesn't want him to go to Darth Vader because Luke clearly has an attachment to the idea of his father, and discovering that Darth Vader is his dad, like, that's horrible and bad, but at the same time, you know, he is a kid who grew up without a father. And
he bounces from father figure to father figure throughout the course of the thing until he becomes the father figure at the end of The Force Awakens.
Right.
So, it is a bad father figure.
He's a delightfully bad father figure. Mm-hmm. He's not the best. But yeah, that's kind of the big point. And to me, that is The Empire Strikes Back's biggest legacy, its biggest footprint in pop culture, is that reveal. Because now so many things have to have a story twist. Like, you just, I don't really think you got that in narratives before that. Like, yeah, there'd be story twists and plot twists, but nothing like, hey, here is a fundamental, like, reversal of everything you thought about the main character, and it ties them to the villain. Like, that, you just did not get that before. And now everything is like, how is the main character connected to the villain?
Yeah, which is bad.
And you can't even do that anymore because it's such a cliche. Like, you've got to do something else.
Right. It got so bad with, like, Squaresoft RPGs in the 90s. And they were just, like, constantly like, well, Fei Fong Long is also Id, who
Cecil is,
like,
Cecil Cole,
whatever.
Brother. Yeah.
Spectre. Yeah, like, later, Surge turns into Lynx, and they get switched around in a Freaky Friday situation.
Spectre, the James Bond movie, is the worst one of those in recent memory. It's... Blofeld is James Bond's secret brother.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I wiped that out of my memory.
It's really, again, from the perspective where we have it all, it's really interesting to go back and think about that as being such a reveal. Because in retrospect, it's so foreshadowed. Not just in Empire, but like retroactively in Star Wars. There's so much that points to it, and it is such a logical conclusion But I mean, it does like it hits like a twist.
Yeah. And it's really amazing. Yeah. It fundamentally changes the entire arc of the story, like the series.
And there's this little mini cottage industry now in like finding people who actually somehow have not been spoiled to that and showing them the movies in a particular order and getting the reaction to the twists. Like, like you can look these up on YouTube.
Right. And, you know, I feel like this is where the horrible spoiler culture was created. Like that did not exist. And it didn't happen initially, but over time people have become so obsessive about spoilers. Like if you mention any detail of a story, spoiler of an upcoming alert. Movie or game, like you've spoiled it.
Yeah.
They won't watch trailers that are officially released. I understand sometimes those can have a little too much information in them, but I don't know. Like I think if a story is good and if it's well told, even if you go in knowing the twist, it's okay. I've gone into movies knowing the twist and I still enjoy them.
Yeah. I love the feeling of being surprised by a plot twist. And I especially love the feeling of figuring it out like 30 seconds before it happens because you feel smart, but you're just like watching a movie. But like I do think you can go into Star Wars and Empire knowing it and have it still be good. It's still a good movie and it's still a well-told twist because it's partially the Alfred Hitchcock suspense thing. Mm-hmm. About like it's a great twist in the moment and it's a twist that like you would then have 3 years to talk about.
Yeah. Yo, but exactly. Like
you also yes. have that feeling of knowing the bomb is under the table. And you have that suspense of we know Luke doesn't.
Right.
Which I think Mark Hamill does a really, really good job with in that movie. Like his acting in that scene is like wildly over the top, but in a very appropriate and understandable way. That whole sequence, like with the lightsaber fight, is like really good.
Everything on yeah. Cloud City is so yeah. beautiful too. They talk about the overuse of blue and orange in movies these days, but this is where that's from, and it's so good
here.
The scene in the carbon freeze,
amazing.
It's beautiful, and it's just like so striking. But then that carries into the gantry where Vader and Luke have their confrontation, and even Cloud City itself is like beautiful. You know, it's always got that kind of sunset look to it. It's just so gorgeous.
By the way, as an extension to that, this is the only one of the first three films that had a good treatment in the special editions, in my opinion, because it was so restrained and it just accentuated what was good about it instead of inserting a bunch of dumb crap extra things.
Yeah,
they made
Bespin, the backgrounds.
They made it look beautiful. They added some extra shots of like, you know, the Falcon coming in and you see more of it and stuff. And you see a little bit more of the Wampa and stuff. That's fine.
But it's still like, it's very closely based on the concept art and stuff. And it's just there in the background to add to the aesthetic.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. This movie really needed its Jedi Rocks moment.
Oh, God. I hate that. I hate it even more what they did to Jedi than what they did to Star Wars, you know, episode 4. But it's because the director of Return of the Jedi had died. I think that George Lucas had free reign at that time to do whatever the heck he wanted. Mm. And Irvin Kershner was still alive. Yeah, and he's like
George,
his movie. Yeah.
Don't you do it.
Yeah, so he's alive. Thank goodness at that point. I think he's passed away since then, right? Irvin Kershner? A few years ago, maybe? So. Anyway.
The silhouette shot against the smoke when Luke and Vader get the lightsabers out is extremely choice. It's like the best shot in the trilogy.
I told you it's the best film of all time.
No, it's very good.
Everything about it is perfect.
It's very, very good.
So many good shots.
Perfect. Except the med bay scene.
It's not that bad. I mean,
even when I was a kid,
I was like, ooh, that's bad.
It's a little cringy, but
even when I was like a dedicated
laugh it up, fuzzball
Star Wars hater for that decade, that was a thing in my life. Like, I just wouldn't talk about Empire because Empire has like so much like objectively really good stuff.
Mm. Yeah. Hmm. Well, that's all we have to say about it.
Fortunately, let's jump into the video games.
Yeah.
Segway.
So now, unfortunately, we've talked about the movie. That's good, but we have to talk about the video games, and that's bad. I will start out this conversation by talking a little bit about not the games based on Empire Strikes Back directly, but Empire Strikes Back's influence on video games, because there have been, you know, references and things like that. Like Star Fox, very specifically when you're fighting through the asteroid field, mm-hmm. like the patterns of asteroids are actually taken from Empire Strikes Back, and you get that triangle cluster of asteroids straight out of Empire Strikes Back, and you're like, I know what you did. Like it's unmistakable.
Yeah. That's cool.
There's even a little secret hidden in the triangle. I can't remember what it is, but also Boba Fett is widely imitated because he does look so cool in this movie. Mm-hmm. He shows up in lots of characters, including Vile from Mega Man X, who is actually called Vava in Japanese. Yeah, so it's straight like up Boba Vava. Straight there. Yep. Unfortunately, then there are the actual Empire Strikes Back games. And not all of them none of them are good.
No, they're not amazing.
None of them are.
Well, partly because of that disconnect between what works in the movie and what works.
Yeah, it's definitely the hardest of them to adapt, just because of because there's not consistent action through all points of the movie. Yeah.
Like you think about again, the Super Nintendo games were very important to me in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And you think about there's no scene in the movie where Luke goes through the sandcrawler to rescue the droids, but you get it. Like, it could have been there. But there's definitely no scene where, Han Solo murders 100 stormtroopers while escaping Cloud City.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
While collecting hearts.
And not surprisingly, the most prevalent element of Empire Strikes Back in video games is the Hoth level. And by my count, in addition to the multiple Empire Strikes Back, man, it's too many. It's weird. in addition to the games specifically based on this movie, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, unlucky 13 games with stages based on the Hoth scene, including Rebel Assault, Shadows of the Empire, Star Wars Trilogy for the arcade, Rogue Squadron, Star Wars Demolition. Oh, man, I forget that game even existed.
What is Star Wars Demolition?
It's like Twisted Metal, but with Star Wars for PS1. You never played this?
Oh,
it seems like it.
I did not know about that one.
I have a scan of that on my blog. Look it up on Retro.
This sounds
scan,
the opposite of delightful.
It's a really dumb idea. I didn't think to check, but there's probably a Hoth background in Masters of Terras Kasi. But
probably.
There is. I'm okay. Almost positive. So 14. There is. Okay. Rogue Leader, Rebel Strike, Battlefront, Battlefront 2, The New Battlefront, Lego Star Wars Original Trilogy, of course, Star Wars The Force Unleashed, and finally Disney Infinity, which is the only good game on the list.
The Shadows of the Empire was good.
No. It actually was not good.
I like the Hoth sequence on that. You get to... fly one of the snow speeder things?
I mean, as a set
you
piece,
always get to fly a
as a set piece, it's just
that.
Tailor-made to be a game because it can be anything from like this really simple, you know, ships. Because it's these bunch of little ships against these big hulking enemies. And you can adapt that into anything. You can adapt it into a few pixels. You can adapt it into photo perfect 3D.
And you have a very clear objective of how to beat these larger things that requires a lot of movement, a lot of shooting, and a lot of... you know, being aware of other things. Like it's very,
And you can incorporate in your standard, shoot and blow stuff up, but then you've got these fun mechanics built in with the tow ropes and climbing up and throwing a grenade in or all these things you can do.
Yeah. Side note of the side note, the aesthetic of the Disney Infinity figures was very, very good and a very, very good unifying of all the various properties. And I wish they would have done more with that.
I'm sad that Disney killed Infinity because it was like Skylanders and the Lego games, but done well.
They looked so good.
They were also pretty fun. Yeah. Like my nephews, when they come over, that series has been dead for 3 years now and they still just want to play Disney Infinity on Wii.
Well, and especially
they don't
now
even
that-
do anything. They just fart around and attack each other with Darth Maul.
And now that Disney owns literally everything, you could just keep adapting everything into the aesthetic.
That's true.
We could have gotten Aliens Disney Infinity. God. Damn.
You get National Geographic Disney Infinity.
I want my power loader Infinity figure.
I just love that the way that they came up with a way to make everything cartoony, but it all like Jack Sparrow looks
consistent.
He should be standing there next to Han Solo. It looks like he should be standing there next to the dude from Monsters, Inc. It's a very well done aesthetic that is applicable to a lot of things. And I wish they would do their cartoons in that style.
Yep.
Because nobody nobody knows about there being like four Guardians of the Galaxy cartoons in the past 10 years. Anyway.
Wait, so do you think Hoth was the inspiration for a lot of snow levels on other games?
Oh, yeah.
Snow, I mean, there have always been ice levels,
but like aesthetic-wise. Well,
have there always been ice levels?
Before 1980?
Yeah. I mean, Super Mario Brothers 2.
We're talking about like Inception here. Like this is the like a movie that came out at the genesis of video games.
Yeah, so Super Mario Brothers 2 has an ice world.
Like I don't know that you could say that Hoth influenced ice climbers. I mean, maybe.
I don't think riding whale spume to reach high platforms in Mario 2 was inspired by Hoth.
No. There's a few. Yeah,
but if you shy the Smithet has a walker.
It has a rolling cannon.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And an
the
ostrich.
Shy guys have
very,
a
very close. I don't know about that.
It counts.
The ostros.
You combine the rolling cannon and the ostrich.
They're ostros, right?
Anyways.
Yeah, they're like the tauntauns. So, Luigi finds Mario.
Yoshi's a tauntaun.
Luigi finds Mario in the snow. He cuts open an ostro and stuffs Mario inside.
Is took it to the extreme. Han Solo?
Chris just told you not to take it to the
Luigi
extreme.
Luigi is. Oh man, I always take things to the extreme. You should know that by now, Chris. Didn't you see me before?
That was.
Are you doing deadlifts?
Yeah.
That was Daisy.
What are you up to now, Chris?
Dead tauntaun.
425.
Wow.
425 pound deadlift.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Thank you.
You are strong enough to wrestle the ears off a Gundark.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anyway, so let's make a journey through these terrible Empire Strikes Back video games because it's dire. I don't know. The very first game isn't that bad considering it was a 1983 Atari 2600 game. There's only so much you can do with Atari 2600. And, you know, compared to other movie tie-ins like Raiders of the Lost Ark or E.T., the goals in this and the mechanics are very clear and straightforward. You are a snow speeder flying around. It's a Hoth level. You're trying to knock down the walkers.
Yeah, so like as Atari games of that era go, this looked pretty fun for at least a short amount of time. So you've got, it's set up kind of like Defender in that, and it doesn't wrap, of course, because you're stopping the AT-ATs from going one way. But it's got
the
AT-ATs, yeah. But it's got this horizontal flying layout with a little radar down at the bottom that shows you where the encroaching enemies are. And you have to shoot them a whole bunch of times, except that you can like hit them in a weak spot. Every once in a while you get this like random force power up that makes you invincible and plays the title theme. But it looks like it's a pretty zippy little game, I think.
I'm sure I've played it at one point, but I have no memory of liking this game. So it must not be that remarkable.
That game is bisexual.
We talk about the color scheme, the purple and blue.
Purple
and pink.
It is the background of the game is the bisexual pride flag.
Well, all the more reason
and more power to it. This game is one I've never played because I'm traumatized by it. When I was a little kid, my family and I were at a TGNY or something. And
what is that?
It was a family value store.
Thank goodness
it's kind of like a department
Yen's
store.
Day.
What's that?
Thank goodness it's Yen's Day. I don't know.
Anyway, so
he thinks he's funny.
He does. He puts the lotion in the basket.
Okay, just cut that part out.
We were at a one of those like family not a convenience store. It was kind of like somewhere between a Walmart and a CVS, like mid tier in there. Anyway, the point is, there was an Atari 2600 display with Empire Strikes Back, and I was like, wow, I want to look at this. And when I resurfaced a few minutes later, I realized, wow, my parents are nowhere to be seen. And I freaked out. And someone came and said, are you lost? We'll call your parents. What are their names? I was like, Mom and Dad? I don't know. How am I supposed to know what my parents' names are? So, yeah, so that's what I always think of when I think of this. I was very young when Empire Strikes Back came out. I remember going to the movie in the theaters when it was, I guess, like first or second run. And I spent the first half of the movie thinking like that Luke's quest for Yoda, like Yoda was the name of his Tauntaun. I didn't realize the Tauntaun was dead. And I was like, Luke wants to go find his Tauntaun, Yoda, because you know, that was his pet and he misses him. And so he's got to go find Yoda. And like halfway through, you know, I finally realized, oh, Yoda's a little green guy. So what happened to the Tauntaun? My parents were like, shh, just watch.
What happened to the Tauntaun? That's adorable.
Anyway,
he went upstairs to a farm where he can run and play all he wants.
Also, there are no Tauntauns in the Atari game.
I saw this film, you know, we had it on a VHS tape taped off HBO, and we didn't have Return of the Jedi or the first Star Wars film on tape. So I watched Empire Strikes Back over and over again. I had no idea what was really the story and stuff. I just liked to watch it. So, you know, when you're a kid, you don't follow it. And yeah, I didn't know it was a big reveal or that fit into a bigger narrative. And, you know.
Yeah, I didn't. I don't think I actually saw them until the real releases. So, yeah, like I was like one for when the first one came out and four when Empire came out. But I think I saw them on the 10th anniversary. They put them back in theaters. Wow. So I saw them.
Cool.
All right, okay. So
but yeah, so video game.
That's the Atari game.
Oh, the other cool thing about the Atari game is you can actually land your speeder to repair it, which is kind of a cool little mechanic. Yeah, like this little bit of lunar lander in there, or chop lifter or something. Yeah, it's got some good ideas for. I don't think it would hold attention very long, but it's worth a little look.
Okay, that's actually not the only Atari game. The other Atari game was made by Atari, but it was just in arcades, and that was a vector game similar to the original Star Wars. In fact, I believe it was a conversion kit.
Yep, it was a conversion kit.
Because it was like, your Star Wars game has been around for like 2 or 3 years now. It's getting old. You want to put some new quarters into it. So let's fight some snow speeders, or fight some some AT-ATs with a snow speeder. Yes. Just go slaughter some
Tauntauns hunting.
So it's
with your T-16.
Isn't there a Womp Rat like level in the Super Star Wars where you're shooting Womp Rat?
Yes, Super Star Wars there is. Yeah,
of course there is.
Sorry. So this is a vector game.
It's a conversion kit for the original Vector Graphics arcade game, and it of course does the Hoth level, which looks really cool because you've got these big Vector Graphics AT-ATs. And then like you shoot them and then it just goes on to the Falcon shooting TIE fighters. And then the final level is literally just dodging the asteroids in the asteroid belt. And then that's the end.
Wow.
Exciting. So this is a game that really had a problem with like the pacing of where the action scenes are in Empire. And like, there's no space. There's no like vehicle action in the entire back half of the movie.
I would have liked to see. You know, a first person view of you walking through the corridors of the Millennium Falcon trying to find Leia.
Trying to fix the hyperdrive.
I think that was a little beyond the engine of
this arcade game.
I've never seen this game in arcades.
Apparently it was really not successful. Like, I think a lot of arcade owners just didn't go for the conversion.
I still see Star Wars.
Right, because everyone loves the original Vector Star Wars, and so that was still making money, so it's like, why bother? And then again, like, the one cool thing about this conversion is the big Vector AT-ATs, and they are cool, but then there's like really not much else to recommend it, and it's also really short. You can like blow through a sequence of it in like 5 minutes, I think, and then it just recycles.
Well, I mean, Star Wars is pretty short.
You can do that
too.
In Star Wars too, yeah, but I don't know.
The idea of an arcade game is like put a new quarter in every 3 minutes,
right?
So that works, but
yeah, but there's aside from the AT-ATs, there's just not much, right? Well, it's a little more.
Was this released as an independent cabinet at all?
No, it was just an upgrade kit.
Okay, so they're like, why would I ruin my perfectly good Star Wars?
I think that's
such a good
happened.
Game,
timeless classic. Yeah.
Yep. So there's, it's. I don't think I've ever actually come across it in the wild, in a stand-up.
I've never seen it in person. It's pretty. It looks neat.
Yeah, it would be. I would love to play the actual AT-AT section on a stand-up cabinet, but I don't know where it's ever going to happen.
All right. So there were no more Empire Strikes Back games for another 7 years. And so that puts us when the series returns, or the movie adaptation returns, smack dab in the middle of the Nintendo era. And so the idea is, let's turn this this very talky, character-focused sci-fi space opera into a Nintendo game. And that means lots of platforming. Oh,
this
my
is
God,
a weird game.
So much platforming. So yes, we have the NES version, and also ported to Game Boy in a terrible, oh, just god-awful conversion. Produced by... Oh, crap, I didn't put it down. Who made this? It was like Sculptured Software or something?
Oh, geez, was it?
Anyway, it was some American company, but it feels very much like a European platformer with very large, open, sort of aimless stages where you kind of trial and error your way through.
Yeah, there was this whole era of platformers where the thing was to have these huge stages and you have no idea where to go.
If you played Earthworm Jim, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's very much that kind of thing.
This was Sculptured Software.
Okay.
Published by JVC.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. The makers of the Kaboom Box?
Probably.
The Kaboom Box. Sounds cool. I have not played this very much, but it looks technically impressive. Like yeah, with like the AT-ATs have some kind of rotation and scaling going on. It looks like
Almost. The graphics are pretty nice on this, and it does combine platforming with shooting stages. It kind of alternates back and forth, and like in terms of what Luke can actually do as a playable character, he's kind of impressive. He starts out with just a few skills, but by the end of the game, you have 8 force skills. Like, I did not know this from having played it because I don't have the patience to play through more than like a level.
Mm-hmm. But this would have been such a good place for like a skill tree progression to have existed, because instead you get this very weird like wrenching of the story into like 8 and 16 bit video game mechanics, because Super Empire plays the same way.
It's similar, yeah.
Like everybody loves that scene where Yoda's like, hey, run over there and jump on these 3 floating platforms, and then that'll teach you how to throw your lightsaber like the Leviathan axe.
Or how to float with the power of the Force.
This is what GamePro rated this game.
GamePro are liars.
Yeah, it's like
there's 4 out of 5 exploding skulls.
Yeah, their highest rating.
Both of the games looked really good.
They did. But
it looks good, but yeah.
They're not that fun to play. I mean, again, Luke as a character has a lot of capabilities. In addition to his 8 Force powers, which include like speed and high jumping, he can do like a Super Mario Brothers 2 style crouch jump where he like crouches down to charge up his super jump. Mm-hmm. You can shoot in 8 directions. He can alternate between pistol and lightsaber. Sorry, blaster and lightsaber.
I do really like the fun little meta narrative between the Super Star Wars games, where
we're not on Super Star Wars yet. This is still
talking about NES.
But it applies to the NES games as well, kinda. Well, Luke in Star Wars just has the blaster and the lightsaber.
Mm.
Then in Empire, you have to like and find the Force powers or
you start getting force powers, find. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then at the start of Return of the Jedi, you just got them all unlocked, which I think is a really fun little way to chart the progression of the character. Hmm. Like, he doesn't throw all his force powers in the fire like Mega Man does.
You do acquire them over the course of the game in this one. And then it does break it up with like, so this one actually, so like the Mode 7 stuff, of course, doesn't happen until Super Nintendo. So in this one, in the Snow Speeder level, it's once again kind of a Defender-esque left to right thing.
It even has a radar on the top of the screen.
And it has a radar. But it's also got some cool features. So in addition to being able to, you know, shortcut destroy AT-ATs by shooting the tow cable at them, it has this thing where if your Snow Speeder gets blown up, you can actually continue on foot and then kind of walk into the background and grapple your way up one of the AT-ATs and throw a grenade in it and blow it up that way too, until you find yourself another Snow Speeder. So that for an NES game, that's actually pretty cool.
Grand Theft Auto kind of.
Then they were like, we have this aerial combat engine. We got to do something with it. So, of course, that means that when you get to Cloud City, you're just blowing the hell out of Lando's security forces. You're like just gunning down cloud car after cloud car.
Lobot must die.
Oh, man. It's like, wow, Luke, you're so bloodthirsty. Of course, at the end of the game, you fight Darth Vader multiple times. He's like tall Darth Vader. He's like twice your height.
Projections of Darth Vader.
And yeah, every time you fight him, you destroy him, and then you get a voice clip. Impressive. Most impressive.
Hey.
Yeah.
And then finally at the end, you kill him and he falls off the gantry, just like Luke was supposed to do. And it's like, time for the sequel.
There's a lot of weird continuity things in here. Like also like when you leave Dagobah to go rescue your friends, the cutscene is Yoda actually tells you to go do it. He's like, yeah, go rescue your friends. Cool.
If honor what they fight for, you wish to do, you must go save them.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Hey, they should have made a Castlevania ripoff with Star Wars, where, you know, instead of Dracula, you got Darth Vader. Instead of Simon Belmont or whatever, you got Luke, and he's got instead of a whip, he's got a lightsaber, and he goes through the Death Star, and he gets. Wouldn't that be a cool game?
Yeah, Darth Vader's head flies off and flies around, and also Luke fights a mummy.
Yeah, no,
and then Darth Vader's final form
turns into a demon. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, there is an NES game where he turns into a scorpion that we talked about last time.
Yeah.
Show enough.
But it also seemed like the other thing that struck me about this game, it seems like just everything is a damage sponge. Like mm-hmm. all the enemies have tons of HP. You have tons of HP, so you can kind of just like brute force your way through things. And
it's very weird that they never figured out how to make the final battle where you can't win against the boss work in the video game.
Yeah.
Or you lose.
It's very antithetical to the idea of a video game. You're there to win. Not to have your hand cut off and your view of your own like paternity inverted and then fall to your death only to be rescued at the last second by your friends.
Press X to deny parentage, I'm telling you.
It's a bummer.
Press F for FU. So
they should have merged Empire and Jedi into one game, so that would be
a long game.
But then they couldn't have made twice as much money.
Yeah. Get a little Mass Effect wheel where it's like, no, that's impossible, and I'll join you and rule the galaxy.
Yeah, that's called the Old Republic, Knights of the Old Republic. Mm, yeah.
True.
That was before Mass Effect, actually.
I know where it's from. Mass Effect
actually has a Knights of the Old Republic wheel in it.
Mm-hmm.
How dare you speak to me like this, Jeremy Parrish?
Speaking truth, I'm sorry. We live in a post-truth world. One final game to talk about here. We've already kind of covered it, and that's Super Empire Strikes Back. Super The Empire Strikes Back for Super NES. I guess this one was also by Sculptured Software.
Yeah.
And Factor 5 was in there somehow also. Weren't they?
Were they one of the...
I don't know. It's like the first Super Star Wars game where it's graphically gorgeous, amazing sound, and kind of sucks.
It kind of hates you. So I also owned this game as a kid, and I did not get very far in it.
This game hates me too. It's weird. It must have a chip on its shoulder.
I think I finished all three of these.
Wow. Did you?
Like on my weekend rentals from Blockbuster, but it was because I had nothing to do for those 48 hours.
Yeah.
With all of these, I would get to I'd rent them and get like three stages in and say, because every level is about twice as long as it needs to be, maybe
so
three
long.
Times.
And then it
every
does them
enemy
again.
Every enemy takes like three times as many hits to kill as it should. They're just
tedious. There's this incredibly long. I mean, granted, it's at least not as like meandering and aimless as the NES version. So they're mostly you can tell where you're supposed to go in these. But it opens with this Hoth level where you're on the surface and then in the ice caverns, and it's incredibly long. And then you finally get to fight this like giant screen filling Wampa beast. Because that's what the Super
well the graphics were
does.
So they oversized
do.
Anyway
yeah so you fight this giant
like
boss
five times the size of his NES version.
And then like you do the Hoth level again like only remix there's another incredibly
you gotta
long
go fight the probot
ice cave
and then you gotta fight the stormtroopers in Echo Base.
I remember this one so long.
I remember using the debug screen a lot in Super Star Wars. Using it a lot in Empire. I don't remember if there was a
was there a level
Truly
select?
There was. Yeah, there was a level select.
Because I have some vague memories of also hating Chewbacca fighting through the junkyard in Cloud City, but I don't think I ever actually got there legitimately.
Yeah. It looks really good.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
It does.
Gorgeous.
The animation on the attacks, especially for Han, like Han's animation does such a good job of like his firing pose.
He carries himself like Han. Yeah.
It's really good. The game is bad. It looks so good.
The sprite work is amazing. Yeah,
the sound,
I love it.
Like you mentioned, the sound is great in these series.
The sound is good.
They really took advantage of the Sony chip in the Super NES to get those samples in there.
Yeah.
But if you look at, kind of the ideal, platonic ideal of the platform shooter as like Contra or Mega Man, this is a really different school of thought because those games are about quick, precise action. They're about, like Mega Man, Contra, you have one, two hit enemies, and also your character dies in Contra in one hit. So it's about like quick, reflex based action. Whereas this is just like you are a guy with a lightsaber, but somehow it's going to take you like five swipes to kill this monster.
Anything. Yeah.
It's
even
like
the
Deadly
little
Towers.
Ones. Like and well and then it also it. Has it also has the incredibly annoying power-up mechanic of your blaster has these incremental power-ups and it gets stronger and stronger and then of course you die and lose it all.
Yeah. And the only one that looks right is the worst one.
You get these like increasingly unlikely balls of flame coming out of your dinky little gun.
the rainbow shaped bats that are the plasma gun.
Yeah, but it's only when you get up to like the final plasma gun that you can actually kill anything in a reasonable number of hits.
Yeah.
Like and then it finally becomes a little bit fun until you die and lose it. And then it's horrible again.
That's when you use a game genie code that just gives you like max power ups at all times.
I think that's really the way to play this
game. You mentioned Deadly Towers, but at least that has a progressive permanent power up system. Like Prince, whatever his name is, Rupert Hector, whatever the hell. Like he eventually like becomes more powerful and stays that way. Whereas here, Luca's very fragile. Chewie's very fragile. You wouldn't think so for a Wookiee, but there you go.
Yeah. And like, and, you know, I understand this comes from an era where, you know, you spent, you know, your $50, which is a lot more now on this one game, and you want it to last a while. And so there's a lot of content in there, and it makes you, it doesn't let you go through it quickly. But even so, it's just, yeah, it's not fun for a lot of the time.
What I was saying about Deadly Towers feel good, like, is that you start the game in Deadly Towers, and then you immediately see the first enemy, and you spend like 5 minutes hitting it over and over again to kill it. And then you go into the next turn, and then you spend 5 minutes killing
it. That's why Prince Meyer has no confidence in his sword, according to the instruction manual.
Oh, man.
The weird thing about it is that, like, the moment to moment actually does feel good. Like, pressing the button and getting that animation is, like, very good. Yeah, and, like, it feels like the animation in the game feels really good, but then you're doing it like 15 times.
Yeah, like, it feels good until things don't die. And like,
it looks good, and like, you start playing and you're like, this rules, and then you get to the first enemy. And
yeah, like, the actual controls and mechanics are fine. It's just, it's sort of the layout and the balance that are terrible. And just, yeah, it just doesn't like you. Like, it throws you at the very beginning of the Hoth level, it starts throwing these giant ice boulders at you with like not much place to hide, and it doesn't like you. And plus all the useful power-ups, which you, of course, really need to make the game fun, because the game is no fun with the Tartar Blaster, are mostly hidden in invisible places where you have to know where they are and swipe the air there. Cool. Half the time you have to be standing on an invisible platform to do it. It's
not great.
Play this game with cheats, then it might be fun. Mm-hmm. Yep. that's
and
my takeaway.
I'm very excited that eventually we're going to talk about Return of the Jedi and have to talk about Super the Return of the Jedi also. I don't know. I think you could probably just carry forward everything we said here. But yeah, at the very end, there is a fight with Darth Vader, and he takes four goddamn ever to kill.
And he throws all the scenery at you constantly. Yes.
And it's cool that, like, you know, the scenery is converging on you, but the further you get into the fight, the more stuff is flying at you. And it's just, I don't know, man.
You could special edition this game into something that was fun.
You could redesign every level and maybe make it better.
Like, change the balance.
Like, keep the graphics and sounds and just like redesign the levels better and rebalance the enemies, and it could be fun.
Yep. Basically take Mega Man or Contra as your ideal and work around those. But that's not what they did.
Nope.
So that's what we're stuck with, this horrible legacy. Anyway. that's kind of a downbeat ending for an Empire Strikes Back podcast, because it's such a good movie. But then again, the Empire Strikes Back kind of had a downbeat ending. So maybe it's appropriate. This is us standing.
Bad games?
Yes.
That's impossible.
Search your feelings. You know it to be true.
No.
So this is us standing on the at the window of the medical bay, looking out of the galaxy, thinking, can't wait till we can talk about some good games again. And ow, my hand hurts. Where'd it go?
There's a game where you play as Luke's hand crawling around.
Here we go, Chris. Yeah, here you go.
We didn't talk about, like, my favorite weird Luke. Dumb bit of Expanded Universe.
You mean Rey? Luke. Rey, who's cloned from Luke Skywalker's hand?
Absolutely not. The hand and the lightsaber show up in the novels.
Okay. No, she was originally going to be cloned from Luke's hand. Yes.
Wow.
The Force Awakens was originally going to open with Luke's hand and lightsaber, like, floating through space. I don't know how they got there, but that's how it was going to start. And thank God someone said, don't do that.
Yeah, very bad. I don't know if this is a controversial statement. Rey's family being nobody's is perfect and should absolutely be what it is.
J.J. Abrams is going to retcon that, and I hate it.
Yeah, I hope not.
He's going to. Fingers crossed. Just watch.
I think probably will change it.
So there's a clone of Luke. His name is Luke. Because it's got two U's.
Luke.
Because
if it were Japanese, he'd have a bar over the U.
Because all of the clones in the novels have the same names as the people they're cloned from, but they double a silent letter.
Oh my god.
So you can only tell when you're reading it.
There's a whole lot of Jangos out there.
Yeah. And there's Joris Kabaeth, of course, who has two U's in his name as well. Anyway, he's evil. He's an evil Luke clone who has two hands and a blue lightsaber.
All right, so we've gone wild.
Now we're really ending on a downer. Yeah. All right,
that's the hope for the future.
Those are the good books. Anyway, so yes, thank you guys for talking about The Empire Strikes Back and related video game ephemera with me.
You're welcome.
This has been Retronauts episode. What did I say it was? 266, something like that.
Yep. Something like that.
Cool. So we did it. We got through this episode. Now we can record another one. Woo-hoo. But before we do that, let's sign off. I'll start. I'm Jeremy Parrish. You knew that. I am GameSpite on Twitter, and you can find me at Retronauts doing podcasts such as this one. And Retronauts can be found at retronauts.com. and on things like the iTunes store and so on and so forth. You can also support us through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. If you pay us $3 a month, then you get every podcast a week early at a higher audio quality and without any of those pesky advertisements that sometimes creep in. So please consider doing that. And if you don't, that's okay. You can still listen for free. Ben.
I'm Ben Elgin. You can find me on Twitter as Kirin. That's K-I-R-I-N-N. Maybe someday I'll have the return of my Tumblr, but today is not that day.
Return of the Tumblr.
Yeah.
And I'm Ben Edwards.
It's a later sequel.
From all of us here at Retronaut Studios, I'd like to wish you,
okay.
wish you all a Merry
this
Christmas.
This guy thinks he's so funny.
Yeah, he does. You know me. I'm on Twitter, Ben Edwards. Chris?
I'm Chris Sims. Twitter's a bad website. Nobody should be on it. But you can find me there as at VISB. That's T-H-E-I-S-B. It's mostly me letting you know when new episodes of my several podcasts are out. Pocket Pals just did a exercise 2.5 hour episode on the Book of Revelation. So check that out. It's a good one.
All right. And that's it for this episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Join us again next week. It is your destiny.